let's make some magic here. All right, everybody just... All right, here we go. Ready? One, two. Welcome to the show. My name is Alex.
I'm Lizzie.
And our special guest is Bob Mann, a.k.a. Frank. And thank you so much for you know, I know there's a lot of planning going into this episode. And I know you have a very busy schedule. And thank you for taking the time. I think we called you like, what, an hour before we were recording. And you still had the time.
Yeah, thankfully it's 2 in the morning here in Atlanta, Canada, and so I'm free, and it's the long night, like in True Detective season 4. It's nighttime all the time, so we have nothing else to do. We're just sitting at our computers and waiting to talk to people.
Well, I
just saw that episode last night. Did you guys ever see 30 Days of Night?
You know, I think I did. I think I did many years ago. Yeah.
I still love it.
Many years ago. But are you talking about the episode of True Detective?
No. I did see, I saw episode 1 last night of True Detective. I'm in love.
Yeah,
me too. But there's a horror movie, Josh Hartnett stars in it, but it's set in an Alaskan town that has 30 days of night.
And it's the same sort of thing where it's set around the big long, after the sunset, the big one. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and vampires set in.
Well, before we get into all that good stuff, wanted to get back to like why we're here, if you don't mind. We are going to be talking season 1, episode 3, Choosing Day, and this is part of our rewatch series. But before we do that, folks, if you are into the podcast, obviously you must be, and you're into Bob Mann and all the other stuff that we do, hit that subscribe button and give us a review. And if you like us, it's Alex. And if you don't, it's not Alex. It's Randall. That said, hopefully we will actually get this done sometime tonight. I know it's not Sunday, but we like to say Sunday is from day. And although I don't have my shirt, you can always go to our Etsy store, which is the What Is From shop, and get your shirts, your mugs, and anything else you want to do. That said, what's your name again? Lizzie. I'm sorry, Lizzie. I totally like drew a freaking blank.
It's
before we get working relationship has transcended names, and now it's just
pretty much
it's just a vibe between you. It's
we just vibe, we don't speak at all.
We just kind of grunt right now because it's so goddamn cold in New Jersey. I mean,
and Atlanta,
yeah. I mean, like, dude, it's not negative, but I know one thing, we like to go hiking, and I don't like to hike when it's like not near my age, and I'm 52, so in the 40s, maybe even 30s, but when we get into the 20s and the teens, I'm sorry, I don't do that. And when it's so cold out that it's like, I have a friend of mine who also lives in Quebec, outside of Quebec City, and she's like telling me it's negative whatever Celsius, and I'm like, when you got negatives going on, I'm sorry, I that's not for me.
Yeah, it's a frame of reference that's it. But the negative Celsius is your like 20s, the low.
I understand, but still, I don't want to need negativity in my weather.
You don't want it's a psychological shift that does no good things for you. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's pretty mild here in Nova Scotia. They're filming from season 3 as we speak. Yeah. And they're outside sometimes, and I got a whole bunch of friends are there and stand-ins to talk to, and people that are just none of them. And I'm like, "What's going on? Are you guys doing stuff outside?" They're like, "Yeah, we're doing stuff outside. It's cold for outside, but it's still doable. They're pulling it off."
Now, have you had a lot of snow?
Not really, no. Like a few bits, a few dustings of snow here and there. There was we probably had one significant snowfall back in December, and that's it.
Because I would love to see like from in the snow. I'm sorry. Yeah. I just would have loved to see what would happen with these monsters. And yeah. I know you can't tell us anything because you don't know anything.
I don't know anything.
Just make stuff up and nobody's going to know the difference. It's just the three of us.
Yeah.
That being said, let me just get back to the question at hand. What is your first thoughts, Lizzie? And I ask you that first because you were in it, Bob. So I just want to ask her first because it's our show.
Well, I also don't expect that Bob just watched the episode. So you didn't.
But it's the script though. I mean, in terms of the script and the episode, it's the one I'm most familiar with. It has, not to jump on Liz's bit here, but I do know that, like, from my perspective, I remember reading the scripts and kind of thinking, oh, the third episode is when a first initial kind of arc of what this place is all about kind of comes home. Right. And I think I said this when I was on the first time, not only is the scene of the choosing ceremony, the first time you kind of see most of everyone there in one place, when that scene was filmed, it was the first time that everyone was together in one place in the cast.
I do remember you saying that. Yeah. And I also, I think, didn't Harold give you guys like a pretty amazing speech at that point? Or maybe I'm thinking of something else. I thought maybe you had said something like that.
So I think, could be making up. I think it was Jack I was referring to who gave a really cool speech when we were filming what was then my last scene, which was at the swing.
Right.
My daughter's swing. One of the interesting things about it is that there was a sense, like Liz Saunders, it was her first day on set.
Jesus.
Like, and she said that to me. I just assumed that everybody were good. They knew each other and everybody was. I remember chatting with her and saying, so, you know, have you been fine? She's like, this is my first day. Like, this is my first time out. And it wasn't my first day, but I was kind of shocked because I realized in that moment that it was in this episode, the shooting of the scenes of this episode, that really people were starting to figure out what the dynamics were and what kind of the tone of the show was going to be. And some of that you figure out in real time. And I just felt very privileged to be there for some of that. It was very cool. Yeah.
I really have to say, this is one of my favorite episodes, and it's one of the episodes I don't like watching because it's so emotional. And I know I'm kind of taking your first thoughts first, but I hadn't watched it in a while, obviously. And I watched it and I didn't, you know, we're going to go through all the episode and she had said, this is his episode. And I'm like, I thought it was next week, meaning the fourth episode, but I remember why you were in it sort of
right at the beginning.
But it's just, it really brings it home. And there's a lot of questions that people outside of From really need to look at, you know, these bigger questions and, you know, where, how do you want to live your life? How do you want to do all these? How do you want to, where do you want to live? And how do you want to live? I mean, you know, you went through a journey but anyway, Miss Liz, what's your first thoughts?
We'll be right back.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4-6 Success Filmmaking. 4-6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4-6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness direct from the voices that have lived it.
I think you just covered it all, and both of you really, because this encapsulates what the show is, like a day in the life when you actually live every side, like you see every scene that someone's going to experience. So, you know, my two favorite things I think in this episode is watching Jade encounter the town under the assumption that it is an extreme escape room, and I loved it. But I also, when Frank's monologue, for one, I really, really loved a lot. But when he is in the box at the end of the episode and the monsters are coming up and he's looking out and, you know, he's seeing the faces and, you know, when we get there, you could maybe tell us what Frank was thinking possibly or what your mindset was for him.
Yeah.
It was, oh shit.
Yeah. I do actually have an interesting thing to talk about at that scene that I don't think we talked about when I was here before that just occurred to me, but I'll save it. I'll save it.
Yeah, please. That's great. And that's another reason, you know, we're doing this rewatch and it would be nice if we could have certain people come on so that, you know, I don't know, like honor their effort in a particular episode. And, you know, when I was thinking about it, I was like, I think we would be remiss if we didn't invite Bob back on to have him hopefully want to share this with us. And possibly now that there's a couple of other thoughts that at least I have, you know, maybe you can give me your thoughts, whatever they are.
Sure.
You know, whether I'm on, off, or like, what are you talking about?
Well, it is always interesting to rewatch an episode of a show, you know, that's a mystery box episode, you know. I think I said at some point in one of our conversations that the show Lost has been one of the shows that I've rewatched a number of times with each of my kids as they come, as they get to a certain age. And every time watching it from the beginning, you're seeing things and picking up new things in the context of how you know the story goes.
Right, exactly.
You're hearing that moment in episode two when one of the characters basically summarizes the entire show.
Yeah.
Which seems so innocuous and you know, not very weighty when you first see it, but then going back and watching again, you're like, oh wow, they gave us some pretty big macro long range hints off the top. And I've certainly watched the first few strokes of From in the same way, going, huh, I wonder if there's going to be something someone says or a bit of dialogue or an exchange between two people that actually, you know, foretells the long range arc. I don't know. Like, you know, who knows, but it's an interesting exercise.
It is. And there's definitely, I actually, when we get to scene 15, I actually circled the word lost, because there was something about that. But as we're going through this, we can acknowledge that, you know, we've watched all the way through the second season, but also in light of that, having that, you know, basis that we can look at this differently and catch something we didn't catch before. And yeah, I definitely have some of those things going on.
So yeah, why don't we get into the cold open?
Sure.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
Bob, you're up.
Just start and fire into it. When the show opens, we're treated to a nice little tableau of Colony House, and we're moving through Colony House, and we see the kind of stuff that people get up to when they're just hanging out, chilling at Colony House. Stuff like they're smoking. People smoke cigarettes, darts, as we call them here in Nova Scotia,
oh,
in
wow.
Colony House. You see some people hanging out, having sex with each other right out in the open. There are no rules at Colony House. You just do you at Colony House. And it can be jarring depending on your sensitivities. Of course, there's lots of sleeping going on, including the Matthews family, who have had a hell of an ordeal, just a bucket of syrup of a time. And they're exhausted. They're sleeping. But Tabitha is sleeping fitfully because she's dreaming about the events that have led them up to this point. Hammering on the door, trying to get into Colony House, seeing the monsters, not knowing what the hell is going on. And she's probably low-key traumatized on some level. And then Kenny's gunshot wakes her up, jars her out of her sleep. She sees Julie sleeping. She's having a hell of a panic, and Jim comforts her. And that gives us a sense of where this beleaguered family is finding themselves at this point in the story. I don't know if there's anything you want to comment about there, but I to me, this is just some bit of place setting to bring us speed as to what's going on with these folks.
Agreed.
I mean, I love this because, yeah, it is a lot of place setting. We really don't know anything about Colony House.
No.
Except for they have guns. The guy at the front door won't open it. There's Fatima and Ellis, and Donna runs the show.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much all we got. And then the next day, you know, it's like the headache after the party.
Yeah. For all we know, this is like a frat house, or it's, answer me these questions 3 to get in the front door. You don't know. We don't know what the deal is here with this thing. We just know that we were in a town and now there's this old Victorian cool mansion up in the middle of a field, which is, you know, again, I do think that the place setting of showing us what people do in Colony House kind of gives us a sense of the dichotomy, which I think turns out fairly quickly to be a false dichotomy. Yeah. You know, it's really only kind of notional that Colony House is where you go to live life to the fullest and enjoy the debauchery of the senses. While the good Christians live down in the town, like that, it doesn't really play out that way.
No. Well, what's interesting about that whole dichotomy is, to your point, they do have a lot of rules.
Yeah,
and they have very strict rules. It's just everything. Once you're inside those walls, anything goes. It's just you know,
you have to be able to get in those walls.
Yeah. And there's a lot of good things, you know, I keep going back to, and I said this, I think in the last two episodes, Donna, I think last season said it was either last season. She said, everybody gives Colony House the bad rap, but you know what? One, we're a family, and two, you know, we live life a certain way.
Yeah.
And that's all we do. It's not that it's better or worse. We just, you know, it's not as crazy as you think.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think Donna would allow it to be that crazy, because she's pretty an old curmudgeon, so to speak, in a lot of ways. So she's not going to put up with that crap.
But surely though, the show demonstrates, and you know, you look ahead to the two seasons, surely the show demonstrates that Colony House is worse, isn't it? Like the place is only ever going to be as secure as your laziest or most unpredictable person. And if you put 20 people in a place, you're raising the possibility and the probability that someone in there might get a little unhinged, or they're going to be sloppy, or they're not going to know. Whereas if it's just you and your family, if it's just 4 of you living in a house, or a couple of 2 or something like that, you can be like, okay, unless you got an alcoholic dude like Frank, who doesn't know
how to use some nails.
Yeah. Doesn't hammer the window shut or whatever. Like, okay, but I for have the most a, part, yeah.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How long do you think Frank and his family were in from?
Oh, it's so good. I believe when I was sort of, you know, and I wasn't doing like a deep history or anything like that.
I'm
an actor that kind of looks at the text and draws everything I have from the text and a lot of the background history work that's sort of hypothetical and not informed by what you're reading. doesn't help me all that much a lot of the time. But one thing that did occur to me though was that they've been there long enough that he's kind of lost hope and lost a bit of like aim. I pictured them as being a family a little bit more, and I actually think this is informed by the narrative. I think what you're meant to understand is that Frank's family is perhaps, when they showed up at Frumville, they were maybe a little bit more like the Matthews family.
Yeah.
The reason I ask that,
what can happen. You're seeing what can happen to people if they get broken down and lose hope. His wife clearly did. She seems to be doing just fine. Right. Yeah. But that does fly a little bit in the face of how long they got away with having the windows not nailed shut. It sort of implies that it's a new problem, but I think they've been there for a while. I think they've been there like a couple of years.
The only reason I ask is I take question with your wife. Like, why the hell didn't she nail the freaking windows? And again, I'm not, you know, I mean, it's just, I know there's no answer for it, but it's just like, it's so annoying because you go in the box for that. And she's just as guilty. And yeah, a man protects his family. Get that. Yeah. Totally right. But dude, a mom protects his her daughter.
Yeah.
And that really made me mad. That really made me mad. I'll tell you this.
My friend Ann Doyle, who plays my wife on the show, has never once expressed an iota of remorse or accepted any responsibility for what happened to our pretend fake characters.
And you know something?
I've always been hurt. Yeah.
You should be. You have every right to be hurt.
Thank you.
Oh my God. He's responsible for your death.
I feel very
seen. And Bob, I was just going to try to get her and your poor daughter to come on and to surprise you. And it's not going to happen, unfortunately. But I think it would be like more of like a Jerry Springer type of thing where, what is your problem, woman?
Yeah, surprise.
Frank is
not the father.
Exactly.
Maybe that's the whole problem. Maybe she dropped that bomb when you got there. And, you know, why do you felt hopeless? All right, so let's go on to Jade. Yeah.
Let's move on. So what goes on?
We'll be talking about that for hours.
Yeah, Jade wakes up in his room. He's all tied up and stripped because he was a whirling dervish. Like he was just causing all kinds of problems. Who knew what the hell this guy was going to get up to? He's nuts as a bag of hammers at this point in the story. So Don has got him all strapped down to the bed because you don't know. He'll break stuff. He'll steal what's his name's peaches. So she's got him all tied up and she basically says to him, listen, there's more going on here than what you think. And he's like, this is nuts. This is crazy. What's going on? Let me out of this bed. So he demands that she unlock him. And she's like, no, no way. And then, of course, he plays the whole, well, listen, I'm someone important. I'm a big
wheel. You're one of them. You're one of them.
Yeah.
I wonder if Donna knew who he was.
Well, I mean, we're not 100% sure. Like, is he supposed to be? I mean, I guess at this point in the story, we're meant to understand that maybe he's like
a Bill Gates kind of guy.
Yeah, well, I don't think a Bill Gates kind of guy because he'd be – like to me, that's a little too big. Like I think maybe he's Sam Bankman-Fried before he was Sam Bankman-Fried. Like something like that, right? Like he's on the verge of becoming maybe some kind of tech.
He's the Woz before Woz became the Woz.
Yeah, like something like that. I think that's what it's meant to be. And again, you know, we don't know how time works, right? So maybe he's been a big deal out in the world for a couple of years. But maybe only a month has passed in Frumville. We don't know. We don't know. Yeah. So, yeah.
Right.
There's an interesting question. A total side note for the viewers. If they do get out, what will time be? Meaning, will they go back to when it was? Will it? I mean, it's just something to throw out there.
All right. Yeah. All right, let's get through.
We're never getting through this episode. No. I swear to God.
We had better get through this episode.
There's so much to think about. Okay, I'll try to go a little bit faster. So
no, it's not you, it's Alex.
It's my fault this time.
I mean, one of the great things about this moment, though, in the episode, is that when Jade pulls the whole, listen, don't you know who I am? Donna's reaction really does underscore this attitude that exists in the town of, like, it doesn't matter who you were before you got here.
You're here now.
You're here now, and we're all on the same, we're all in this together, same playing field, which you know, creates a bit of tension for Jade that takes him basically the entire episode to let go with. He still kind of walks around with this sense of, like, I have a special sense of entitlement for no other reason that I think this is a game and everyone else is an actor in it and this is all for my benefit. It's so narcissistic. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's fun. This episode, you get to see him kind of reduced down to everyone's love. And then we cut to Boyd, poor Boyd, waking up in his little, Dickensian cot in his sheriff's / post office, which is just so charming. And he goes and checks on his cell dude, and it's poor Frank. And Frank checks out the box. You know, the box is sort of foreshadowed. It's going to loom large over this episode. And checks with Frank, and poor Frank has just been reduced to a shell of a man. And says, no, I don't want anything. And then tells him that, you know, Lauren always liked him. Lauren always liked the sheriff because she thought he was going to get everyone out of here. But so much for that. Wah, wah. And, you know, that the whole thing went to shit. But then Frank does tell Boyd that he wasn't always like that. Tells Boyd that things used to be different, and that there is one thing he'd like to do before the whole thing gets wrapped up, because we all know what's coming. And that's the end of that. That's the end of that first little stretch.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he really does, you know, Frank really sets the table for what happens to him. And he's trying to redeem himself. But I think basically he's just like, I'm done. I mean, I just want to go home.
Yeah, what's the point, right? Like, there's no.
I mean,
you still don't have a sense. You know, you have a sense that he's got to go in the box because it's already been introduced as a concept, but you're not sure how it's going to play out. This is the Dead Man Walking / Law and Order episode where it's sort of like, well, is this the kind of town where we send a guy to his death, or do we play it a different way? This is the prototype.
Yeah.
Right.
This is, and we don't know that off the top. We don't know that until later on in the episode, but the box has not been employed.
Yeah. No, it hasn't been in play.
Yeah, that's right. So that's important. And then we cut back up to Colony House, and Donna's sitting with Jade having a come to Jesus moment where she's trying to talk him through the business. And he begins with one of my favorite lines in any movie or television show where you're meant to understand that someone has just been told something. And it's when a character says, so let me see if I've got this straight. You're telling me that. You know, like it's such an effective thing in a TV show. It summarizes well. It's efficient. It cuts down. But I don't know that I've ever in my life, frankly, said something to someone or had something told to me, and then either one of us followed it up with, so what you're trying to tell me is, and then basically repeat what it is that
exactly.
Wait a minute. Yeah. But Bob, you have kids.
Yeah.
And you must have caught at least one of them doing something, and they tell you the story. And then you're like, so you're telling me.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose that's maybe a real.
No, your kids are perfect, right? Just like
I've never
daughter.
Had to do that, Liz. Like,
I've seen the pictures. They are perfect.
Yeah, we're gifted communicators in this family.
Yeah.
We just make everything work on the first round because we don't got time to rehash it. Right.
Yes, well, you exactly. guys are from Canada. You're like the nicest people in the world. Nothing.
Yeah,
ever
just nice on. To each other, and everyone listens carefully. That's what we do. But yeah, so basically this is the, you know, this is the summary moment where Jade's like, so you're telling me this, that's what this is. And I was like, yeah, pretty much. That's the size of it, buddy. And Jade looks around at people and he's like, is this for real? And, you know, Ellis or whatever, they're like, yeah, this is for real. Sorry. That's what you're stuck in. And that's when Jade has the idea that, like, that Toby, what a clever, what a slippery fish, set up this elaborate birthday party, Michael Douglas, Sean Penn-esque game, Rube Goldberg, for me to escape from. And I guess I'm going to have to solve the mystery of the mysterious town.
I love, the best part is Ellis is like, do you want me to go after him? And Donna is like, no, just let him go to town.
Let him go. Who knows what's going to happen to him? His wires are going to fry, but let him go. At least we don't got to look at his hairdo anymore. Like, just let him go. Let him go. Yeah.
I love his excitement through the whole thing. And then I'm looking at him and he's got like a Beach Boys shirt on.
Yeah.
Like the Beach Boys Oxford, like, you know, a boy of summer. Like he's fresh there off the boat.
He's fresh off the boat. Yeah. Yeah. It's bad. So he comes out. So he leaves the house, you know, it's like, sunlight. What is this all about? And he checks out some stuff that's going on. I see a note here. This is really fun. So Jade sees a sculpture, and he comments, "It's not quite his Giamatti." Is that did I pronounce that right? Giamatti.
Giamatti. I've never heard of the guy. I figured I'd look it up. And
yeah, fun little footnote for the for the listener, because these are the kind of details that may hold the secret to deciphering this show. So
I'll tell you right now, Bob, will in Lizzie's eyes, everything is important.
Yeah.
Until it's the
key.
Not.
It's the key is that sculpture.
Yeah. Well, listen, you know, but not for nothing, you know, and I can't remember where everyone is in terms of Lost. You know, we keep going back to that example, but like, you know, there's a character in that show whose name is John Locke.
Yeah.
And then later on, he assumes the pseudonym of Jeremy Bentham. And unless you've studied philosophy and you've gotten familiar with some of those works, I mean, that's just going to go right over your head. They're just names. Right.
Right.
But
right
once
right,
you
right.
know that those names are taken from philosophers, you know, around the time of the Enlightenment or whatever, then you start to understand, oh, there's something else going on with this show. Like that's not accidental. That's in there on purpose. And it's shedding some kind of light on what sort of attitude or what kind of issues that the show is kind of touching on. It is kind of an early hint, right? It's an early giveaway that there's something more informing it. But Alberto Giamatti, it says here, is one of the most important sculptors of the 20th century. His work was particularly influenced by artistic styles such as Cubism and Surrealism. And if you find Fromville and its shenanigans and goings on either surreal or cubic, then perhaps there is some, I don't know what cubic means, I just threw that out there, but perhaps there's some relationship between this 20th century sculptor and from, I don't know, maybe the whole place is sculpted. But what does he see? He sees Clara riding her bike, takes it from her because it's his. Everything here is his for the taking. He take whatever the hell he wants, right? Yeah. This is an escape room for him to play in. And she's kind of surprised by this and taken aback. Because that's not a thing that happens. And then, you know, it's not a motorized scooter that he's accustomed to or a hoverboard, but he just takes it and he just scampers off like a little scallywag to explore the hints and clues of the town. And there it is. We have,
I'm not aware world. If you know that we have had two contests at the end of each of the seasons.
Yeah, right.
Where we ask people to draw a scene from the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Someone drew that.
Beautiful.
And it is so good. Yeah. It's just so good. I'll send you a picture of it, but
yeah, I want to see it. Class warfare comes to Fromville via Jade.
Yeah, they nailed the whole feeling.
Yeah.
Of it's what like, you're, happened.
You're giving yeah,
it's
this.
On it's in our intro, and it's also on our YouTube channel. Yeah. As well. Awesome. We'll send you a better picture. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Might I say, it is inspiring. What a kick-ass escape room experience that would be. Like, have you ever Have you ever done an escape room? Like, we go in the room and things are hidden. There's keys in little bottles, and you got to solve a little, you know, a Rubik's cube, and that unlocks the thing. Imagine a whole town. That would be awesome. It would be awesome. It would be crazy.
But I would ruin it for myself because I get so deep into my head that I'd be freaked out.
Yeah.
And the one escape room I went into, I was just like, this isn't real. This isn't real.
Yeah.
Just walking through the whole thing.
And then me, I'd still, they'd have to say, dude, we're closing. The key's right there. Get out.
you'd be wandering around the town. Just sort of not sure what's going on. And Liz would still be on the bus studying the upholstery of the seat.
Pretty much.
Like there's something about the weave.
There's something about the
seams of the seats that holds the clue. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God.
That's right.
Let's get back to the Matthews.
We go back to the Matthews family, the poor Matthews family, who've just, wow, what a roller coaster ride. And poor Ethan, he's all banged up. He got an old timey spear through the leg or whatever that was that he got impaled by. And he looks out the window and who does he see? I think maybe for the first time in the show, we see the boy in white out there.
No, it was the second time. Was this second the time? Second? Yeah. Cause okay. he saw him the night before.
Ah, okay.
And he wakes up and the kid's still there.
Okay. Yes. Can I just say something about this real quick?
Yeah.
Isn't it kind of a little creepy the way he looks at this kid? Like
the way Ethan looks at him?
Yeah, he's just kind of like, it's kind of like he's almost looking like your kid would on YouTube, just kind of like zoned out.
Yeah.
And the boy in white
is zoned out.
And then the boy in white isn't looking like, he's looking a little freaky too.
Yeah.
Because he's a boy in white. And he's
It's almost like neither boy has ever seen another boy before.
Kind of, you know?
Yeah. Right?
They're like, oh, I thought I was the only one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the boy in white just kind of waves and smiles.
Yeah, like he's like,
it's
hey.
It's not like,
no,
like but that.
He's like, I see you. Yeah. I see you. I see you, therefore you are. And Ethan is like in a Descartesian kind of way. And then Ethan is kind of like, I see you, but I'm not sure if therefore you are. This is all new to me and I'm not, I mean, I think you're real. Like I think he sort of takes for granted that he's real. Everyone's taking.
I really wish this was a more popular show and it could be on Saturday Night Live where they could have the boy in white doing different things. Like I got to go to the bathroom or brings out food or, you know, I can see a whole skit with this. Sorry.
Yeah. Or he needs a nap.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. Yeah. So Ethan sees the boy in white and he's just like, oh, interesting. I'll log that away in my head for future reference and not say anything to my family that does not validate anyone's feelings at this point in the story, which is one of their big challenges. So Ethan wants to go outside and play, you know, because he's a kid and he's also made a new friend. So he wants to go outside and hang out and maybe play, I don't know, throw rocks at birds or something. And Tabitha says, no. You got to stay in bed because your leg got impaled by a footstool leg or whatever
something
it was. Ethan, you know, Ethan's he's just a dumb kid, so he starts complaining right off the bat. He's like, these pajamas are too itchy. You know, Julia comes in and saying, you know, look, I don't like people going through my stuff. This place sucks. People were having sex out in the couch. Yeah. I don't know if she says that, but surely she saw it. And Ethan's
they were
like,
right here.
Yeah, yeah, like they're
like
right there.
Around the corner.
I mean, honestly, that is an image you just can't get rid of.
No.
For a while.
I don't know who those people were too. I don't know who they got to do that. I really never bothered to look into it. But presumably it's a couple of background actors that they just pulled aside and said, "Hey, listen, we got some interesting things for you today." I don't know if that's how it worked. I have no clue.
I know. I did hear on the wire that you did try to apply for that particular job though.
Yeah, on the list I went in. Yeah, so I did a good self tape for that. But no, didn't even get a call back for the sex scene.
Damn.
You got
Yeah. No. That's probably the only other scenario under which my mother would say, "Yeah, I don't think I can watch that show." Like, I know you're in it, and I hear it's cool, and people are talking about it, but I don't think I can watch it. Like, really, getting killed by monsters or having sex on a couch in front of a bunch of people. That's probably it. Those are probably the two deal breakers.
Oh my god!
Fandom. Yeah, yeah.
I'm so glad that you have well defined. rules with your mom.
Yeah.
So
you just know what the boundaries are. Yeah. So. So the kids are like, the kids are like, this place sucks. How long are we going to be here? What is going on? We got to take off because these clothes are too itchy. And Tabitha says, we're figuring it out. Don't worry. Pump your brakes, kids. Mom and dad are going to figure these things out, even though we don't know this yet. But mom and dad have passed the point of trying to figure things out. They have called it quits, and no one knows this yet. So that's a neat little bit of stuff to reflect on now that you know the deal with them. But anyway, they're hungry. Ethan, I love this note. Ethan wants hobo eggs.
Is that when you cook them in a plastic bag in water?
I thought it was when a hobo freshly lays eggs. I thought that's what that was. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
I don't know what hobo eggs are either.
I don't know what they are either.
No.
But no. I'm going to nitpick a little bit because we're in second episode.
Third.
We're trying to learn about, the third episode. We're trying to learn about where this family has landed. And you do get a clue that something is off because we know that all their clothes are back in the RV because Jim has gone back to get them.
Right.
Ethan's in pajamas and he's complaining that they're itchy. And I think the three of us are old enough to remember those kinds of pajamas because if you look at the style,
they're 70.
Then you see the cowboys on them. Remember your flame retardant pajamas when they first came out and they were kind of stiff and weird fabric and they would be itchy.
Yeah.
I remember those and I was like, he's wearing some dead kids
Velcro pajamas.
Yeah, that's what they felt like. So he's like sleeping in some dead kid's 1960s pajamas.
Charming.
And then when his shows up, they're all soft. They have sharks all over them. Like the style is totally changed. So that's all I have to say about that. He just needed the Halloween mask that we used to have, those creepy masks.
And that's why kids these days are not resilient. They're buttercups that can't withstand any kind of pressure. It's because they don't wear those itchy pajamas like they used to back in the 70s.
I think we're solving problems on all fronts here, Bob.
Yeah, I'm very pleased with the progress that we're making. So, so Tabitha says no. There's no hobo eggs. You got to eat cream of wheat or porridge or whatever the colloquialism of the day. In Frumville. So Julie's like, screw this, I'm going for a walk. I'm gonna go out.
I know, right?
I'm gonna go out in the dangerous world that is, I guess, okay because it's daytime. I'm sorry. I wouldn't be going outside for weeks.
You think?
What I saw after what she saw.
Yeah.
Dude, well, I'd be getting drunk every night.
Yeah, you'd be freaked out. You'd be totally freaked out. And you'd be like, I don't care about how many hot Ellis's there are out there walking around. I'm not leaving this place. I'll watch from the window. Like, I'll watch them swim in the lake from the window. Thanks. So,
exactly. So
Tabitha goes out for oatmeal. Ethan looks out the window. Boy in white is there, but he's not smiling anymore. He's just looking back. And so there's a little bit of tension. But Ethan waves because he's friendly and he was raised right. And the boy in white, he smiles and he waves back and it's like, oh, damn. This is going to be a match made in hell. These two friends, this is going to be bad. And, and in this room, there's wallpaper and the plants are hanging to dry. There's a painting over the fireplace mantle of a woman. And you're like, what is this place? Is this Rousseau's wax museum? What? Yeah.
I never got to go back to there's plants hanging to dry out, like in herb, like as an herb, like, you know, dill or basil or mint or whatever. They're just hanging to dry. Yep. But there's a painting over the fireplace and it looks like it's a woman, but, you know, like say like a early 20th century, something like that. But it looks like someone painted white rimmed glasses on it.
Oh,
yeah. Like they've, I don't know. It was just something I caught. Not a big deal.
I bet if you look really close, you can see eyes behind the woman moving.
actually, Bob, it's actually that cat. It's the cat clock from Clue that goes back and forth.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, that's where the mole is. The mole is behind the painting, watching everyone and reporting back.
Oh my God, it's Donna. And she put glasses on because she couldn't see clearly.
And she has to run from room to room, following people, looking through the peepholes.
All right, let's get to the series part. Back at the diner. Back to the diner. By the way, folks, just so you guys know, we are trying to do a rewatch of season one, episode three, Choosing Day with Lizzie and Bob. Man, and hopefully Lizzie will let us do it, but she's just keeps interrupting.
And I don't have much to say. I really don't.
I'm not going to let you guys take responsibility for how slow it's going. I think it's me. I think it's mostly.
I really don't. But by the way, since we're talking about you and it is all about you, do you have anything coming up that you've been doing?
We filmed a much longer format season three of King and Pawn back in late November, December. And it is crazy. We did a musical episode and we did a film noir episode and we did a flashback Hallmark spoof episode. And we just went crazy. We partnered with it's the guys who produce Trailer Park Boys. And they said, well, why don't you do season three with us? And we'll give you 6 22-minute episodes instead of the sort of the Bell Five. So we just went, man, we're just going to do crazy stuff. Reed sings in it. And we've got all kinds of, bunch of fun, just super fun things. And season two of King and Pawn comes out in a few weeks.
Awesome.
So we did that last year. So that's fun.
And where do you, in Canada, where is it on usually?
In Canada, you can only see it on Bell Five, which is like one of the Canadian carriers in Canada. So you need to have that service. But then season three, and actually seasons one and two are going to be on the SwearNet, which is an online streaming service that the Trailer Park Boys have, and you'll be able to see all of it. And it's a subscription to SwearNet is only like a couple of bucks. It's like $2.50 a month. Like anybody can get it. So once it's up, I'll let you guys know. You'll be able to watch the whole thing. You could see me and Reed and a bunch of our friends, and you'll see some people from pop up here and there. Some people who've shown up and done little one-off things and stuff like that.
And the best part is you survive.
I know. Both of us live. Yeah.
You didn't get killed off.
And it's a comedy and it's fun. And yeah. Anyway, so there it is.
Let's get back to the supermarket.
We get to the diner. You know, Liu and you know, Mr. Liu, of course, has just been found dead. So these folks are reeling from that loss. It's been a terrible. I mean, episode two was just a mess, right? Like, it was a crazy mess. So the dust is settling. We're in post dust settling mode, and she's flustered, and Kenny's flustered, and you know, he's trying to clean up a little bit, and you know, she's mourning and grieving and stuff like that. So there's a lot of tension between the two of them. Note here, the glass and the broom dustpan are blue.
I don't know what it means yet.
Not a coincidence.
You know what it means? They found it at Walmart and it was blue.
Yeah.
It was a dollar.
And there's only one. There's only one Walmart in Frommville. And when you go into that Walmart, you can never leave. You're stuck in Walmart, which is not that different from a regular Walmart.
Pretty much.
Which is probably the inspiration for the show, honestly. So, you know, she feels really guilty and bad because she sort of thinks that, you know, Mrs. Lu, she thinks if she'd been there, maybe things could have been a little bit different. And Kenny's like, no, you couldn't have done anything. Like, you wouldn't have been able to help Dad. Like, this was going to be bad no matter what. Sarah comes in, and we all know what Sarah got up to, but nobody else does. So this is a real tense moment for the viewer. They're like, oh, she's a snake in the grass. And she's responsible for Mr. Lu getting killed. So, right? This is a Three's Company moment where somebody knows something that someone else doesn't. And it's all just a parade of nonsense. But she feels bad. She does feel bad. You know, I think she does feel guilty, and she wants to help. And she looks up at Mrs. Lu, and that's the end of that little tense setup. I don't know if I explained that all that well.
Yeah, that was really
no, hard. You did a great job.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think Mrs. Lu, you know, what I find really fascinating about her is she's very focused on what she does. She's that old school. She might break something. A typical mom. Hey, we got customers coming. I don't have time for this. Let's do this. And
keep calm and carry on. Someone dies, you get back to work.
And the fact is, I didn't want to say this to Lizzie, but the glass, when it actually broke, it was in the shape of the Chromanocle. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm so kidding.
If you frame advance.
You turn it upside down. It's the map. No.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I think that the relationship between her and Kenny is just so sweet. And I mean, on a serious note, you know, like I said, I love this episode, and I didn't like it for the simple fact that it just was really emotional for me. Because I had a close relationship with my mom, and my dad died when I was very young. So it was just kind of like,
you
know, it was really, they did a great job.
There's a lot of relatability in different places, depending. There's almost a little bit of something for everybody. It's like something horrible has happened. Things were cool. I mean, one of the interesting things about this moment in the show is that you're told in no uncertain terms that things have been pretty quiet for a long time.
We, 96 days.
Yeah, we got into a good groove here. We had a good thing going on, and now all of a sudden, everything goes all to hell. And whose fault is it?
Frank.
Not Frank. It's the Matthews family for showing up and just spreading their gospel all over the place and driving off when not listening when they're told. Frank gets a bad rap, if you ask me.
I think you're really trying to do a good job of, you know,
exonerating Frank, but it's not going to happen.
Frank's just having a good time. He just wanted to watch the football game and have a few drinks. That's
just
all.
A good exactly. Time
yeah.
Boy.
For a month with your buddy.
Just said Andy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's all Reed's fault. So So back up at the colony house, you know, outside near where the boy in white was, Ethan goes out and Victor's there with his open lunchbox, and he's pulling out his paper and crayons and he's counting his steps and the ground's muddy. And you're like, what is up with this guy? This guy's not an ordinary person.
He's special.
And how much of Victor, remind me, how much of Victor have you seen in the show until this point?
Second scene.
It's only his second scene.
The first scene was really creepy because he asked Julie if she wanted some peaches. And then what's her name? Fatima told her to go away.
Right.
Shoo him. Grab your peaches and shoo. But let me ask you this question. What color is Victor's crayon?
Oh, my God. It's blue.
It's blue. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. I'm telling you.
the conclusion I've drawn is that everyone in From are sad.
Oh, because of the blue.
The blue.
You know, it's another clue that they're sad.
What?
They're in From.
They're sad.
Yeah. That they went to a funeral.
They're just sad because of the circumstances.
Yeah. Okay.
But the blue really reinforces it.
It does. You know? If we missed it.
We're going to actually change the theme song to Am I Blue?
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, I wouldn't invalidate that. I mean, I you know, there certainly are lots of great pieces of visual storytelling that use color to kind of like underscore things or reinforce things and stuff like that. And sometimes they act as clues and, you know, in an M. Night Shyamalan kind of way, you know, or it's like everything's red, you know, when there's a dead person around or whatever. Right. Like yeah. It could be a clue. It could turn out. You may turn out to be vindicated. And me and Alex are going to feel pretty stupid.
Hey, Bob, hope to God that we are.
Yeah.
I hope to God she's right with all this. I hope she's right with all of this.
Yeah, that'll be a very avant-garde bit of storytelling if we find out that Lizzie's the mole. Like the mole is a fan and they don't even know they're the mole. That would be cool. That would be like
I'm the one in the painting looking.
Yeah. Four-dimensional.
Bob, it's going to be a St. Elsewhere ending.
Yeah.
Do you remember St. Elsewhere?
Yeah, it's an autistic kid's dream.
Yes, it's exactly. That's what it is.
Yeah, that's St. Elsewhere. It was all made up in the kid's mind. And because St. Elsewhere featured a whole bunch of crossovers of other shows, there's actually a whole universe of TV shows that are part of this kid's imagined universe. It was a mess.
And the whole problem was, because she's from Boston, he wanted to go to Duncan.
Right. Yeah, Duncan.
There is no other place to go.
No.
All right. Can we get to the supermarket, please?
Yeah, super. So, where were we here? So, yeah, so we have the scene with Victor that really does tell you that he's a character in the show and not just like a creepy bit of furniture person that we get introduced to be like, there's weird people in Colony House. No, this guy's an actual thing. And Scott McCord is so great, isn't he? Like, he's just remarkable. He's such a great presence as an actor. I love
him. And I got to tell you, you know, meeting him versus. Like, you don't know what to expect if you never met him before.
No.
Like, when you watch Victor, and he's, like, the coolest guy ever.
Yeah.
And you're like, what the hell? There's some serious acting going on.
Yeah.
And he's very, I mean, and I say this, him, Liz, and Harold are the anchors of that show. And I wish they would get, I know Harold gets the pub, because he's the star, but Liz and Scott have to, I don't know how you do it, but they got to get the recognition.
Yeah. I mean, their characters have a real, they're very rooted and cemented in something very consistent. And it's, they're the fulcrums around, I think, around which a whole bunch of other things revolve. Yeah. I'm always very compelled when I'm watching them. Do their work. I mean, I'm sure I said this, but Harold has one of my favorite line reading of the show in two seasons. My favorite. It's from the very first episode, and it's when he says to Kenny, "We got to put this talisman in the RV, and you know that's all we can do. We can't get these people out of here, so we just put this in the RV and hope for the best." And Kenny says, "Do you think that's going to work?" And Harold just has this great line reading where he goes, "I don't know."
Yeah, I know.
he could have said, "I don't know." He could have made it really dramatic and kind of grave, but there's something so genuine and truthful. But like, "I don't know. I'm making this shit up." Like,
if I go on.
It's beautiful.
I really wish he would break the fourth wall. I really do. Like, just look at the camera and be like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, what an interesting show it would become if people just broke the fourth wall and they looked right at us. Yeah, that would be awesome.
Oh, my God.
So here's the bit. So Colony House, front porch, one of my favorite places in Frontville, the front porch of Colony House. And Fatima comes up to Julie and she's like, sister, here's some berries. You've been through hell. Have a few of these berries. And Julie's like weirded out. She's like, I don't even know if I want to learn any of your names. And Fatima's like, you know, we got an apple tree. We grow our own food. We got all kinds of cool stuff. Supermarkets are terrible. Like basically the, you know, the dairy consists of a sheep that you got to like slice skin off for bacon or something. I'm making this up. She doesn't say any of this stuff, but Fatima's clearly trying to make her feel better, trying to make her feel at home and say, look, you're in safe hands. There are people here that are friendly and you'll be okay. It's weird for everybody at first, but you'll be okay. Then Fatima gives her a hug. And that's your first sort of introduction to the idea that maybe Julie is going to be more comfortable at Colony House than with her own family. Yeah. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
There's that. We get back to the Matthews sleeping area. Jim's back from the RV. He's got a whole a laundry basket full of clothes. He's like, I found all of our stuff, all the comforts of home with me. And he's got pajamas and with the sharks on it. And Jim says, yeah, everything's cool, Tabitha. He's got books. Ethan's happy because he's got his Adventures of the Grand Gulagog and the flight of the Crominacle and the Adventures of the Grand Gulagog Concords. And Ethan's happy about that. So he's like, okay, I got some of my fun things. Tabitha says, yeah, those are my favorites. They're trying to normalize family a little bit, I think, in this scene, like trying to focus on nice little things.
I mean, he asked Tabitha, you know, when are we going home?
Yeah.
And she gives a mom answer, like, we're trying to figure it out. Like,
trying to figure it out.
I don't have a fucking clue either.
Yeah.
So.
And there's this lovely little moment when the parents, you know, become Crominacles. I mean, they have no idea what they're doing, but they become Crominacles and, you know, they make the funny noise. And there's this sort of like, well, you know, kind of a life is beautiful Roberto Benigni kind of moment where it's like, well, we're clearly in the sixth circle of hell, but we're going to play make believe for you to distract you from the truth of it for a few minutes.
Is this what Frank did when they first got to Fromm and it just went down the hill?
Probably. Yeah. Probably. Yeah. He probably was like, oh, yay. Finally, we've made it to Disneyland. This is.
I'm trying to build the case for you.
Yeah.
That Frank is a good guy.
Yeah.
He was a good guy.
Convinced his daughter for the first 8 months that they were in Epcot Center.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. It's just a really long line.
Yeah, that's right. You got to wait till your phone pings to tell you that it's time to show up. That's what. That's what they're doing. So, but Julie's not down with this.
She's like, she's
too old. She's too old for this shit. She's like, yeah, I'm not here to do playtime. There's serious stuff going on and this is bad. So you guys just cut it with your shenanigans and or goings on. I'm not messing around with this stuff. So she's getting real surly. She's a teenager and she's not putting up with this stuff.
Not so easily fooled.
Yeah.
Not that's looking forward to that.
And then we get the bit where it's like, okay, Father Cotri's here to give you the tour of the town. And he'll fill you in on all the sixth and seventh decimal places of what this place is all about and what you're going to have to do.
Sorry, but yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at Julie through most of this episode, and she's just a sourpuss. Mm. And given that it's the day after they were on the porch, I guess I don't understand why she's not holding on to her parents a little more than she is.
Oh, yeah, I know why.
Oh, why? Yeah.
Because she's a bitter teenager and the world revolves around her and she's just pissed off.
Yeah.
But I kind of just don't get why her fear isn't driving her toward them. Instead, she's basically pushing away and saying no more.
Because, no, I think that's a good point. I think the reason being is she knows what's going on. Remember, she knows what's going on.
What do you mean?
She knows that they're splitting up.
Oh, but still, well, and, I mean, and, that whole family,
she's trying to have like a little,
must have seen, made them look like frauds to her.
Yeah, but, yeah.
But also, she looks at Fatima and Ellis and Colony House, where they treat her like an equal.
Yeah.
And then to top it off, Father Khatri with the tour, what do they tell her to do? Watch Ethan.
Yeah.
Like, she has no opinion, even though she's 16.
Yeah.
Or whatever age. She's a teenager.
Yeah, it's and, clearly part of it. Yeah.
You know, although I don't have a teenager yet, I can feel the shift
coming for you.
Starting.
You're getting
and
there.
It's not fun as having a 9-year-old.
Yeah. You're getting there. But
It's getting there, as you well know.
So here's a fun bit of trivia. In a version of the script, you know how Frank says to Boyd, there is something that I'd like to do.
Yeah.
Right. And then in the episode that we see, he's taking Boyd to this like tree swing that he built for his daughter. In the first version of the script, that is not where they go. They go to the house, and Frank walks in. Frank is in the room where his daughter and wife died, just to be there one last time when the Matthews family show up.
Oh, wow.
True story. That's
what creepy would that
now be? Was there a monologue with it? Like a big monologue did you have?
No, not in that scene. No, it was not in that scene. The monologue still happened at the choosing day thing. But I think in an earlier version of the script, there was a joint scene between all of them at the house. So Frank's there, and the Matthews family come in. They're like, "Oh shit, we got here wrong, at the wrong time. Sorry, buddy." And he's just like, "Yeah, I just need a couple of minutes, and then I'm gonna go." And then the tire swing or the trees. Swing scene wasn't a tree swing scene. It was at the grave.
Oh,
when he tells the story of building a swing and how all that stuff, there is no actual swing. They're at the grave. So I think there was some moving of some things around, maybe for practical reasons or to give the thing a bit more flow or not be using the same locations. Cause there's still the scene with Toby when he takes Jade to the, so I think that would have been like a repeated kind of like, location beat or something like that. So they just kind of diversified. I don't know what the thinking was behind it, but I just know that there was a version of the script that had some things happening in different places, in different ways for me.
And right now, Lizzie's trying to figure out how that relates to the whole,
how that plays in
theory.
No. I'm just thinking about that. You know, had they had you at the cemetery as well, you're right. It would have been too repetitive. But what I can't understand is why the heck Frank would create a swing for her out in the middle of the woods where the monsters live.
During the day.
The day's okay. Yeah. During the day, you just got to worry about the jackals and bears that are in the woods. You don't got to worry about the monsters. And then you just teach your child how to deal with those kinds of wildlife, which is a good fatherly thing to do.
Do you have ticks up in, this is stupid, but
oh, yeah.
You have ticks in Canada? Do?
Big time. Yeah. Yeah. I remember, you know, getting ready to be part of the shooting of season one. And one of the big things, you know, there's a number of things they sort of walk you through. Okay, we're going to be outside a lot. So here's what we got to keep in mind about being out in the sun, sunscreen, hydrating and stuff like that. But there was a whole thing I remember reading in the sort of like orientation sort of package about ticks.
Yeah.
Did you have snake wranglers? We're out in the woods. We're literally out in the woods. It's like real. These are real. This is a real place. Yeah.
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 And how long was that episode? How long does an episode take usually for you guys or for them?
I mean, I guess it depends. But like, you know, I don't think I would be too off. It depends on what's happening in the episode, of course, because some things take longer than others. But I'd say like 5 five shooting days, maybe like 5 or 6 shooting days, depending what's going on. If you, and again, you're not just shooting the one episode. Like right. you might be shooting like the very, very first scene that I shot, which was on like day one of filming. And this was the first thing that Harold did too. Like my first moment in the thing was also his first moment as me as Frank and him as Boyd. And it was him dragging me up the stairs and throwing me against the wall.
How did that, I mean, given that you didn't know each other, you know, Bob didn't know Harold all that well.
Yeah.
Like, was it difficult to get into that intensity? I mean, did you guys do anything to warm up prior to that?
Oh, yeah.
To establish something?
Yeah, we had a really, really good stunt coordinator, and we walked through some of the combat pieces and, you know, how to take the bump so that it was believable. And, you know, so we did the dragging up the stairs, throwing against the wall, screaming in my face, punching me, pushing me through the doorway, showing me the, and it's actually my friend Anne in the bed. They built her into the bed and she's all messed up. And then it was a dummy. They didn't have the little girl there. That would have been a bit much, but you know, throwing me down on the floor, holding the gun to my head, you know, I grabbed Kenny's feet and, you know, Ricky's feet and stuff like that. And it just, that was the first day. All of that stuff was day one. And we did all of that in the sound stage. We didn't do it. Yeah. That wasn't out at the house on location. It was like, in the studio where they built all the sets and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was the kind of intense for everybody because nobody really knew, you know, there was a real sense of, kind of excitement at the end of the day. Cause it was like, oh wow, that really worked.
It really did.
We pulled that off. That was really cool. And it was chaotic and, you know, hard on the walls and the set and a lot of tossing around, but just get a sense of how out of order things get filmed and kind of how all over the place. Like the first one I did was that, and the last one I did was out at the tree swing.
Wow. Yeah.
So everything's kind of all over the place. You're filming chunks of different episodes sometimes on the same day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of hard to say how long it takes to do an episode because it's a bit like a jigsaw puzzle. But for the most part, it's like a couple, two episodes, three episodes per block, you know, which is like 3 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of shows will film in blocks and you know, they'll switch off directorial teams.
That's right.
In order to do that.
Yeah, you know? it's a good way to organize it. It keeps things cohesive and you know, sort of a through line for at least a couple of episodes. So
Yeah, exactly.
Good.
So
back to the episode.
Yes.
Let's see if we can do this. Let's try to motor through. In the kitchen of Colony House, Father Cotry's there and he's visiting with all of them. And he's like, this is how this works. You get to choose where you live. You either live here up in Fun Colony House or you live down in Akron, Ohio or whatever the town is supposed to be, right? It's like the town from Leave It to Beaver or something like that. He's like, so you get to choose. And yeah, Julie wants to go down for the tour. She wants to see what the place is all about. And they're like, no, you got to look after your brother so that he doesn't take off with, you know, Children of the Corn out there. So
yeah,
so that's cool. She's not too happy about this. Tabitha's like, you guys stay here with the kids. But then Father Cotry's like, I think they should all see it. Like they really, everyone's got to, there's this sense that everybody's got to get normalized to this place or else they're not going to survive. So they all go. They do all go.
Julie doesn't go.
Julie doesn't go. But
neither does Ethan.
Because Ethan's not supposed to be out of bed.
Right. It's Tabitha who thinks that she should stay with the kids.
Right.
Father Cotry is like, no, you come with me. Your kids are in great hands here with Donna and Victor. The sex couple will babysit them and you come with me. We're all set. we get to see the diner. We go down the diner again, and people are standing outside the diner, and we get the great scene in the diner with Jade, where Jade's like, "Ah, oh, I'm going to start my investigation at the diner." Presumably, he's just been cycling around the town in circles for a little while, now he's back. Meanwhile, back at the diner, and he makes a bit of an ass of himself. He's talking about this place being a puzzle, and he's looking for clues and treating everybody like they're actors at Universal Studios or whatever, and he's just doing his thing, right?
Yeah.
And lady tells him that there's a line, and I think that's my friend Rebecca who says to him that there's a line, and he's like, "Yeah, listen, you know, I know that there's rules, but I'm hungry and I want some breakfast sausages and tater tots." So
And I paid for all you guys anyways. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, like, yeah, but yeah, this is for me. This is for me.
Yeah,
I'm the guest of honor. So what are you going to do? And that's
I loved how he just took the plate out of the guy's hand.
Yeah, he's just like, you know, whatever, right? Like, I can do whatever I want. And then Mrs. Liu puts him in his place.
She comes up and hits him with the
whip. She smacks the shit out of him. Just boom. Just
with a spatula.
With a spatula. And he's like, "Whoa, this is really realistic." And Sarah's waiting on tables. And she goes outside to meet her brother, and she stops him, and he's like, "You know, what are you doing here?" You know, apparently she was going to stay home, and she's like, "Well, that would have been pretty conspicuous if I had stayed home and not shown up for work."
Yeah.
There would have been, "I cannot afford to lose shifts.
I need the money.
I'm saving up.
I live off of tips.
Saving up for that trip to Atlantic City. And you gotta let me work." So, you know, she tells she wants to help. She needs to help. She needs to be there. This is what she needs. We're still not 100% sure, I don't think, at this point, whether she had some kind of out-of-body experience or whether she's got maybe some kind of split personality thing going on, or she was possessed by some otherworldly thing. It really is a lead that gets buried early on in the show.
Yeah.
This idea that she's, you know, that, you know, about the monsters.
Yeah.
And you know about the nighttime stuff, but then there's this whole other angle where she's being manipulated by some unseen force. You almost forget about that for a little while. Like they drop it on you and then just shove it aside and let you get on with getting to know the place.
Isn't that like a Lost thing?
Yeah, sure.
That in Lost?
Yeah.
There's lots of, I mean, it really is one of the interesting things. I was actually thinking about this watching True Detective, you know, thinking about how, like, I love these shows where they leave you wondering for quite a long time as to whether what you're seeing happening is paranormal or metaphysical or whatever, or if you're kind of being tricked into thinking it is, but actually there's a real world practical or scientific explanation for what's going on. This show, obviously, with the monsters and stuff, you're like, okay, well, these are actual monsters. Like, this is a thing. But then there's a whole other thing where you're kind of like, wait a minute, are there ghosts here? Like, is it, you know, is it Invasion of the Body Snatchers type thing? Do people get possessed by spirits? Or, like, it kind of does play at the fringes a little bit of what kind of thing it is. And it leaves you wondering for a while. And it really throws you off, I find. Yeah.
Like
everything all at once.
Yeah. When she came into the diner and was helping them clean up the glass, I just thought she gave Mrs. Liu the most evil look. And, you know, I don't know. And then she's telling her brother that she needs to help. And I'm wondering what she meant by that.
Yeah.
What does she need to help with?
I took it to be pretty genuine. Like, I think.
But is she helping those forces? Or is she trying to help Mrs. Liu after she arranged for the murder of her husband?
Yeah, I mean, my read on it, you know, we sort of went down this road a little bit, I think, last time. Like, my read on it is that these are genuine, These are genuine expressions of like a character. Like the, like I don't see a lot of duplicity in what people say and what they do. And in fact, I think if there was duplicity, that would be a pretty, you know, I think I did say this last time. Like, I really don't think there are moments where people are pulled aside and they're told, listen, here's what the script says, but we actually want you to kind of give away some little hints that you mean something different than what you're actually saying. I don't think that actually goes on. I think the text is what it is and people are playing it straight. They're playing it. And if there is weird stuff going on, that comes out in the, in the narrative. Like my read of Sarah is that she's unwittingly and under some duress being controlled by another force. And when she's pleading with her brother and she's saying, I need to be here and I need to be helping and I need to be doing something, she means it. She's not trying to slip a Mickey Finn to anybody or pull a wool over anyone's eyes. No. I think it's narratively important that you understand that she is in conflict internally and that she's not trying to dupe anybody. Right.
Yeah.
In fact, I personally, and I know we talked about this and debated it, I don't think there's a single character that is trying to dupe anybody. I think everything you're seeing from everyone is what you're getting. And the mystery is in the mystery's in the world of it. The mystery's in the circumstances of it. Yeah. I don't think there's any secret agents or anything like that. It'll be quite a thing.
I believe that of her more toward the end of the season than I do at this point. I don't know. I agree to a point up until the, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm open to it. Yeah, but I do think I think she does 100% mean it when she's struggling with this moment where the voices, whatever they are, tell her, if you want everyone to go home, you got to kill this kid.
Yeah.
And I think she struggles with that. And she's like, well, I didn't like that piece of instruction. That gives me bad feelings, but this place sucks. And wouldn't it be great if everyone could go home and maybe the sacrifice of one person is worth it? And like, I feel like you see that ethical dilemma play out in what happens with her character. I think she genuinely, and in that sense, it's not unlike what someone goes through in a cult or you know, when they fall into a bad community that is bad for them, but it's a community. And if that's what you want, you're what you're looking for. Okay. Well, then you're going to do some weird stuff in the name of having people around you who care about you. Like it plays into some of those energies a little bit for me. Like I find it entirely compelling. I don't need more than what they're showing me. I don't need a deeper mystery. I find the character tensions and conflicts are enough. I think they do the work. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, that's that piece. Then we get I think what is a pretty key moment of the show. We get Father Cotchery basically laying out the groundwork for the Matthews family and by extension, the viewers, right? Father Cotchery's like,
absolutely.
Everything you've seen happen up to this point, here's me telling you what it is. And Sean Majumdar is so good as this character. I was really sad to see him go, but this episode in particular. Yeah. And we spent a good bit of time over a couple of days shooting the different scenes and stuff. And he was clearly having a good time. And there are some little bits and pieces of things that didn't make the final cut that he added, particularly in the marching me to my death scene that are, you know, really, I thought were really elegant kind of additions.
I think they made him a huge mistake killing him off that early.
Yeah.
I mean, someone important's got to go pretty early. And that's the problem.
No, but Bob, that's the problem.
Yeah.
The fans will yell and scream because nobody dies. But then when you kill somebody off, you yell and scream that somebody. So I see it from both sides. But I love what they did in season two, where they did bring him back through Boyd.
Yeah.
And that's a fun way of doing it.
More of that. Like, I would love to see that happen over and over again to kind of make Boyd look crazy.
Yeah, although I'm still like, you know, this is jumping ahead a bit. I'm still not 100% sure what the utility of that device was for the show. I don't mean this as a criticism. I mean it more as like a genuine question, like a genuine curiosity. Like, and I like to think that it's not a I'm going to use an expression that probably some people will think doesn't apply here, but kind of a jump the shark kind of moment. Where the narrative isn't demanding the return of a character, but hey, wouldn't it be cool if we had this actor back for some stuff? So we'll put him in a flashback, and that'll be kind of neat. Like, I'm not saying that doesn't always work, but I'm always sensitive when I'm watching something and I'm going, Is what I'm seeing happening? Because, you know, it's like when Boys to Men shows up on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you're like, well, you know, in the real world, these guys aren't going to show up at a random funeral because they know somebody's uncle. Like, that would be quite an extraordinary moment. But in the world of this show where everybody's famous and this is being shot in Hollywood, I guess you have the Boys to Men show up like that. That's what I mean. It is kind of like a fourth wall break in the sense that it goes, oh, this is a show where people come on the show because they're famous and it's like guest spots and stuff like that. Does that make sense? Like it's this. Yeah.
Out of all the examples you could have said, Boys to Men on Fresh Prince, I don't think we're ever going to get that anywhere else.
Totally random. No. I pulled that out totally randomly. I didn't plan that. It just came into my head.
I'm just saying, like all the other From podcasts, I guarantee you we'll never have that.
Yeah,
and that's what we get with you.
Trivial bit of brick and brack that just pops up out of nowhere.
And I'm like, the sad part is, I'm with you because I remember watching that. I'm totally with you.
Yeah.
So, so what was your thoughts when they were I'm trying to get us back on track here.
What was
your thoughts when the Matthews saw the room, your daughter's room? I mean, that was pretty. Holy shit, this is real.
Yeah, and it certainly is very jarring, and I think puts a really fine point on the predicament that they're in, where it's sort of like, well, here's the house where you would live if you choose to live in the town. You've had a taste of Colony House and the couch sex mascots. Like you've seen what that's all about, but now here's a house where someone died less than 24 hours ago, and they were torn apart here in one of the kids' bedrooms.
Oh, by the way, here's a gallon of paint so you can paint over it.
You can paint over it. May I direct your attention to the beautiful crown moldings over the doorways that are just lightly splattered with blood? Don't worry about that. We're going to paint over that with a nice eggshell white, and you will enjoy this house right down to its chocolatey center. Like, there is something very jarring about it being like, oh, there's time is of the essence here. They got to choose soon, and there's no time to reupholster this place. Like there's fresh massacre here in this room. It's like, oh shit, yeah, I guess that's how this goes, right? This is what happens in this place. So
you get it as is.
Yeah, you get a free house. What I wonder is like if they hadn't shown up, and what happens with Frank and his family is entirely incidental to the beginning. Like, there really is no relationship between the two, dare I say, inciting incidents. There's the Frank's family being killed, and then there's the Matthews family showing up. And both of those things happen independently. If the Matthews family hadn't shown up, and Frank's house becomes newly available because of what happens, do they go to someone in Colony House and say, hey, you know, we're going to draw lots to see who is there anyone who maybe has run the course on their time here in Colony House who would like to live downtown, down in the suburbs? Like maybe someone wants to move. I'm curious as to how that works. Like what are the logistics or do they just leave that house empty until someone shows up, or do they have a conversation about this new vacancy that has popped up? I don't know.
Can anyone claim it?
Yeah, and who gets it? What are the rules of that? You know, it's a curiosity that I had. You know, how does the real estate market work in Frommville?
It really is. I mean, it can be a hot and cold market there in Frommville.
Because Cotri's kind of doing double duty as a realtor.
in this scene.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah,
he's a definite hype man for the town.
Yeah, he's like, it's a fixer upper, but you know. Yeah, so they have some conversations. There's a bit of theorizing going on here, right? Like Jim and his engineering head, he's like, maybe we're on a fault line, or maybe this is maybe this is Dante's Inferno, or maybe, you know, whatever. And they want to know the science behind the talisman. It's like, we don't know how this works. It just works.
Yeah. Right? That's all that matters.
And we protect each other. And then out on the streets, Khatri finally gives us the lowdown on the box. The box is where you go if you goof and we can't have you around here anymore. So dun dun dun, we get the whole box, and it's like, oh, that seems pretty harsh. Yeah, you haven't seen the half of it yet, Jim.
Yep.
You wait and see how bad this shit gets. Hold on. Yeah. And then they go to their house. So we get to see the house, we get to see the room, and you know, this is what happens when you break the rules, and Tabitha and Jim are quite rightly freaked out when they learn about what went on in this place. And Tabitha is so freaked out. She's like, I got to get out of here. This is a place of death. Yeah. So off they go. Yeah.
And then we get one of your big scenes.
Yeah. We come to one of my big scenes. They're out walking through the woods. Honestly, if I had to confess something, I would say this is probably the only scene. I was very, very happy with how everything turned out. But I remember watching this scene and feeling like, I wonder if I could have played that a little differently.
Like, do you do that often?
No, not often. No, I don't, because I really do kind of separate myself from the stuff, you know, whether it's comedy or whether it's, you know, this or that. And I've become quite, I don't mind watching myself in things, and I've become quite desensitized to it. And I can almost watch stuff and like not even see me and just go, okay, well, I'm into the story. This is the story's doing its work if I'm not focused on my own part. But this is one part where I think I was a little thrown off by the space.
Yeah.
By how, like, I felt at the top of the scene, I projected a little bit too much. And I don't know, like, it's one of the rare moments where I found myself kind of being a little bit picky about how it turned out. I still think it's a fine scene. The scene is really more about Boyd than it is about Frank anyway. Yeah. Cause this is the scene where Boyd goes, wow, he's really milking this. He's really making a meal of this whole broken man thing. Maybe I shouldn't put him in the box. Maybe that's what kind of a town are we?
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like
that, this is the doorstep of that moment, and that scene that he's going to have with Khatri a little bit later on. So
yeah,
it's an interesting little bit. Colony House, we're back up. Ellis, who is like a real, sort of Inspector Gadget, Red Green type character. He fashions, whittles a crutch, I guess, for poor Ethan with his fucking Bowie knife, or like what? Like what? Like how did he make this crutch? What did he do?
I know.
Salvation Army, or what? Like, where'd he get it? What'd he do? We don't know, but he just has this crutch and he gives it to Ethan. So they're all friends now. And Ethan hobbles around a little bit, and he's adorable. And Fatima tells Julie that Ethan's adorable, sweet little boy. And Julie's like, yeah, screw that. He sucks. and Julie's like, you don't know us. You don't know how dysfunctional our family is. And Fatima's like, who cares? We're all in this together. It's what we do. We're family.
Yeah.
Right. We're the Sopranos. So this is good. So Julie's starting to be like, yeah, okay, Colony House starting to look pretty good. And then we get back to Kenny and Jade together, and Kenny and Jade have an interesting little, interaction. And Kenny's sort of humoring him a little bit with this escape room type business, right? You know, Jade's sort of pitching him this idea that this is all pretend. And Kenny's like, yeah, you haven't talked to a whole lot of people yet, have you? Like, is there, like, what information have you been given? And Jade's like, well, Donna talked to me. She's the games master, clearly, but she didn't tell me what to do next. You know, I don't know what to do. and he starts to scrutinize the escape room a little bit, nitpicking it and being like, yeah, this could be better, that could be better. And, you know, and he's like, one of the things, I think we talked about this, one of the things I like about Jade in this moment, I actually think the third episode is a really great time for this to happen in the early life of the show for a viewer who's watching it and trying to get into it. Jade basically steps into the shoes of the discerning, skeptical viewer.
Yeah.
And he's pointing things out in his mind about this escape room, the deficiencies in the in the logic, the flaws in the ointment, which really could very easily stand in for an audience member going, wait a minute, where'd all these cows come from?
Exactly.
What electricity? Where are these chickens come from? Like, this doesn't make any sense. He's almost disarming a viewer with those kinds of thoughts by giving voice to it within the show, which I thought was quite clever. I thought that was a clever approach to take. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that too. Yeah. And then, you know, Kenny's just like, well, they're just out in the woods. We don't even know where they come from. And that seems like a lame answer if this really is an escape room.
Yeah. Kenny channels Boyd's bit from episode one. He's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know where the chickens come from, man. We can't leave.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You're going to analyze this to death? No, we got to survive. So, yeah. And then Christy shows up. You know, is Christy come in? Yeah, Christy comes in to check on them. You know, and Kenny tells her who this guy is. He's like, yeah, he's the other guy, not the dead guy, but the other guy, obviously, from the car. And he's up to no good. He's causing problems here. Yeah, and then they have a little nice little moment. They hold hands, Kenny and Christy.
Yeah. And we're just like, really ooh.
You're like, oh,
there's a little something.
Yeah, they were up at Colony House.
Little hope.
Yep.
And then, honestly, we have one of my favorite scenes of the episode, which is the episode between Victor and Ethan.
Yeah.
Where he's like, what are you doing? What's going on out here? It's like Forrest Gump and his son. Like, what are you watching? What's happening out here? He's like, I'm counting steps because the trees are moving. You're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
What is going on with this guy? And they form their little like mini alliance. It's like, I'll help you. I'll watch for stuff. And they have a little conversation and, you know, Ethan's asking too many questions, but you can tell the Victor kind of digs him in a way. It's like, he's got a little buddy now. So that sets the stage for moving forward. But there are certainly some cryptic things that get said.
Yes.
In this scene. About the trees moving and about all kinds of weird stuff.
Their boy in white.
Boy in white comes up.
In common,
That friend of yours, Tell him that Victor says hello, which is like, oh. I mean, that's interesting, right? Because it tells you that this isn't something that only Ethan is seeing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's important.
And it made me wonder because we don't know a heck of a lot, but knowing what we know, has Victor not seen him since he was a kid? Can only little boys see this kid? So, and it goes from, you know, because Ethan thinks that the kid lives right out in those, you know, in that little patch of woods right there, because that's where he keeps seeing him. But it just, it tells Victor that he wasn't imagining this kid.
Yeah.
After all. Like,
that's
this
true. Victor's seems to be a little ho-hum about it, though, isn't he? Like, he doesn't, it doesn't seem to be he doesn't treat it as much of a revelation. It's not like, he's not like, oh, you see him too? He's just like, oh yeah, well, yeah. Tell him Victor said hi. Like, it's this almost like a throwaway kind of thing, which I think is actually kind of cool because Victor is the character that delivers to us this desensitized, numbed, this place is nuts, and I've seen all of it, and I've been here for a long time. Like it's pretty cool.
All right,
chugging along, we're gonna motor through the rest of it. We won't even go into great detail, so we're not keeping
everybody
here forever. So
what? You're not spending the night with us?
Well, you know, we don't. If you want a 3-hour episode, we can. I mean,
I don't want to edit a 3-hour episode, guys.
No, that's right. See, did you hear that?
All right,
executive so producer.
We'll stop at 2 even, no matter where we are. Is that okay? Another 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So okay. Let's get the Jade Cellar.
Let's get the good stuff. The Jade Cellar is great bit because that's, yeah. I don't know if that's the first moment. I think it is the first moment where there's kind of like
a weirdness.
Yeah. Where it's like, maybe we see things that aren't there.
Yeah.
Right. It's the sixth sense kind of moment. Right. So you're like, oh shit.
It's when we go off the rails and we're like, wait, what is this show again?
That's right. And that is what I felt in that moment. Yeah. It's like, oh, this place also plays tricks on you.
Yeah. Right? You know, like I got the sense that, you know, when the guy turns to him and screams, I noticed his blue eyes with the white whites, but all this blood, and you would think that the eyes would be bloodshot or something like that. And Jade is so shocked, he's thrown back on the floor, and he looks up and he sees this weird symbol on the ceiling. And for a moment, he forgot where he thought he was and was completely freaked out.
Yeah.
Like, this wasn't Disneyland where, you know, you know the animatronics are only so scary and you know that they're not real.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Instead, you're someplace else, like in one of the haunted houses where you're lost in your own psyche.
Yeah.
Everything seems real and you're scared. And he was genuinely scared for a moment. And then he came back to himself and he's skipping out of that cellar like, oh my God, Toby, you are a genius.
Yeah. You can tell he's had a moment where he's like, oh, wait a minute. That seemed a little bit too real. Yeah. And I'm just going to pretend maybe that wasn't as heavy as it was because I might have to face an uncomfortable truth if I lean into it.
Yeah, that I'm really here and this is really real.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I don't want to deal with it.
Who wants to?
Yeah.
Who wants to realize that? But yeah.
That's right. And then we have the moral dilemma scene in the church where Boyd, you know, and I think it's probably plays out a bit counterintuitively for anyone who was expecting something different. Boyd goes to Father Cotry for some counsel and he's like, I'm having second thoughts. I'm not sure if we should put Frank in the box. And the godly priest, who you'd think would say, yeah, you know, Jesus, turn the other cheek, all that stuff. He doesn't say that. He's like, well, wait a minute. You made the rules. And now your first opportunity to apply them, you're going to bend. Oh, man, that's going to be bad. Right. Which really, if
the devil was talking,
what's that?
It almost seemed like the devil was talking because right. The priest should have said, turn the other cheek. But instead, he's like, put him in the box.
I think what we see play out over the course of particularly that first season, I think kind of helps you to, I really think that Cotry's character is very well substantiated. Like there's a bit of a reverse engineering, but I think when you come to see where he came from and what he went through and where he lands, you understand that there's this guy who's like, this place is going to go to hell real fast if we don't stick to, you know, if we don't create some tenets and stick to them. Like, I think he's quite consistent that way.
No, he definitely is.
Yeah.
Like, he definitely is. I totally agree with that. But when he didn't give in to Boyd, to me, it just seemed, and I'm not trying to say there's, you know, like the devil has its hand in this show. That's not what I'm saying. Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, instead of what he should have said as a priest, he turns around and he's like, no, put him in the box.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I get what you're saying. Like, they are so on the edge of losing everything in every second that if they set a rule, they have to follow that rule.
Yeah. Listen, this is Frumville. This ain't your daddy's pastor.
Right.
You know, exactly. This isn't youth group.
Like we're here to survive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I dug that scene. I thought that scene was really good. And I love Harold's performance in this scene in particular. Like I was quite impressed at how genuinely torn he seems to be. Cool.
There's two lines that I love about this. You know, Khatri says, when you build a guillotine, you get what you get. You either use it or you don't. And then, of course, Harold's like, you're a lousy fucking priest.
Because
he's not answering it, but he uses that line in season two, too, as well. And I just think that it, your advisor doesn't want to tell you what you want to hear.
Right.
He tells you that's the mark of a good advisor.
Yeah, it's the truth. He's the consigliere, and he's like, you may never use the thing that you've said you're going to use, but if your opportunity comes along where you the conditions are right and you don't do it, you've taken the piss out of it completely. No one will believe that you'll use it, which really, if you think about it, makes Frank a hero in this episode.
Frank is always a hero.
He saves Boyd from having to make the choice.
Yeah.
He rescues him from that predicament, which means we have not yet, in two seasons, we have not yet actually seen Boyd have to make that choice.
Right.
Like, he does take Sarah off into the woods, but he comes back and there's still this question kind of floating over everything. It's like, will they do this? Will they use it? I'm not sure that we'll ever see the box get used again, but hey, I'm open to being wrong about that. But anyway, so there it is. Boyd comes back. He has this scene with Frank where he basically tells him, I've made up my mind and you just need to take off and live your life whatever way you want. There's a shack out in the woods because that's a great way to go.
Great place to live with your talisman.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's essentially an outhouse with, with a hook. Like, so go live there rather than die. I think in my imagination, Frank went out in the woods and he checked out the shack and he went, yeah, I think I'm going to go in the box.
Yeah.
I'm better off dead than
that. No promise in that box.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my fantasy of what you don't see off screen. Yeah. So, but you're left with the impression that maybe Boyd just lets Frank go and off he goes. And which takes us to the choosing ceremony, right? Where we get this whole played out bit where it's like, where you're going to have to decide. And of course, jumping to the end, Julie chooses Colony House, family freaks out. They've chosen to live in the suburbs. In the death house, and Julie for some ridiculous reason has chosen to live in the house where the craziest thing that happens is a couple of people have sex on the couch, and for some reason she's the nutty one for choosing Colony House over the blood spatter house.
I think we also have to talk about what Jade did. I mean,
he
could not have been any more Jade / inappropriate.
And
Boyd does a Frank on him where he pulls him there. Choose, you're out. You know, a man protects his family, and then he's part of the town. And get out of my life.
Yeah, and he shoves Jade's nose like he's a cat who's made a mess on the carpet in the grave. And he's like, take a look at your boy. You think this is made up now? And it's like, oh damn, that's shit. That's crazy stuff. Yeah. So that's really fun. And then of course you get the stuff with Frank and I will say, I think I said this before, that the scene in the jail cell when he says, here, take this talisman and I'll go off into the woods. It was sort of a hybrid of that scene and some of the stuff that I say in the choosing day scene that was the audition.
Oh, wow.
The audition for the role was the Christmas dollhouse stuff
but it was set in the jail cell when he's saying, here, take this talisman and go off. So the script hadn't quite evolved to what it was yet.
That's awesome.
But, interesting little bit of trivia. But yeah, fun scene to do. And so here's another bit of trivia, something that got cut. We actually did shoot it, but it got cut. And this leads into a question you had earlier about what was Frank thinking when he's in the box. There is a moment in the script where Frank says, I think this actually is in the show, when he says, no, I am thinking clearly, you know, like she, my friend Becca, who I think was also in the diner scene, she says, you don't have to do this. And he's like, no, I'm thinking very clearly. I'm going to do this. Yeah. But then there was another little moment where he says, a nice thing everyone could do is light a candle for, you know, my wife and daughter tonight in your windows. And I think that actually plays in the episode. There's a moment where he's looking out the window very early in the moments in the box, and there are lights popping up in the houses in the town, and that's people lighting candles for his wife and daughter. And it doesn't get explained in any way, but there is a moment where Frank kind of smiles a little bit. Where he smiles, and that's what that is about. It's him. It's him seeing that people that people are responding to what his final request to have them honor them for him in his final moments. And they do. And he has a nice little moment before he gets terrified.
I'm sorry, Lizzie. Go.
I was just going to say, you know, after, you know, you talk about the Christmas in the dollhouse, because you said all that in the cemetery, I felt like people didn't want Frank to go into the box, that they did have sympathy for him because they were all going through this whole thing together. And it could have been any one of them that just decided to drink into a stupor every single day.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, they just decided not to. And it was just that one night. You know, whether the monsters knew that it was just Megan and Lauren home alone without Frank, wouldn't have allowed that to happen.
Yeah, there, but for the grace, right? Like, I mean, there is something very, I mean, I think I can understand it on a human level. Like, I think the mechanics of the show kind of work in the sense of, well, if there's this much danger at night, what do you do? What do you do to keep people serious? I mean, in my mind, the threat of monsters killing you is enough. You don't actually have to add another level that says, well, if you screw up, we're going to take away your hall pass privileges for a couple of weeks. It's the cost of making a mistake is about as dire as it can possibly be all on its own. So there is something, I think, a little bit faulty psychologically about saying, We're gonna make the price of negligence so high that no one will be negligent. Well, no one really works that way. I mean, negligence is something that no one realizes that they're doing while they're doing it. It's only after something terrible happens that they go, "Oh shit, I should have been cleaning those filters more often," or whatever. Right. So it is an interesting thing to reflect on. Although I think and I do think that, like I say about the box, I think Boyd maybe as a character evolves to the point where he's like, okay, that tactic just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Like we can't.
And on top of it, isn't it enough that your family was killed?
Yeah.
Isn't that punishment enough?
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. There'd be no, I don't think that anybody would reasonably be like, put that asshole in the box. Like it doesn't really, really play, but it is interesting. There's a march to the box, and it is a lovely, lovely little scene. We rushed to film it because we were trying to do it at sundown.
Yeah. And it didn't look rushed.
Yeah. The window, but it didn't look rushed, but it kind of was like, there was a sense of urgency where it's like, here's how many takes we think we realistically have to get this before we go from it being daytime to too dark tonight to shoot it. And we did the box stuff that same night. So there was a whole getting the monsters ready and prepping the box and putting a false back on it and stuff like that. So
I will say, they do a great job of wrapping wrapping it up at the end. Mm, and, yeah. And it's not just this episode. It's all the episodes. And I like to say, you know, you take stock of all your characters. And yeah. they start with Mrs. Liu at the diner.
That's right.
They work their way to the Matthews. Then, you know, what I love about that scene with Mrs. Liu, she takes a bunch of apples. She brings them home. And she's, you know, praying for her husband. And at the end, you know, you've got Kenny with his stray Jade.
Yeah.
That's where the relationship between Mrs. Liu and Jade actually begins.
Oh, absolutely. It's lovely.
Yeah. And it's that moment where he's so grounded into this hell. And he sees this woman who is genuinely grieving. This is not an escape room like he thought it was.
Yeah.
Like, this is real.
And really, for all intents and purposes, it is the beginning of the show.
Yes.
Like everything that's happened up to this point is like introduction, action, dust settling after the action. And now the new, that montage at the end is basically an expression of this is the new normal of this place. And the fact that new normal happens adjacent to a guy being torn apart in the middle of the town square where everyone can either see or hear
right.
going on. It just adds a sense of urgency to this is the new normal. There is a new kind of danger that wasn't here for the last 96 days, and we've settled into a complacency, and now we're all on edge. We're on edge, and we realize the danger is newly kind of revitalized. Yeah,
yeah,
but yeah. It's a very elegant ending. I quite
and knowing that they have that relationship, and knowing that Jade has such a relationship for a female authority figure, which we're going to find out later. It looking back at this, it's a great, great scene. And there's just all good stuff that it comes to it. You know, I mean, I obviously you were in the middle of it literally, and
terrifying.
No, I know you said that the last time you were, it was as real as it could be for you. And that's amazing. And it was
chaotic. And I don't know if I said this, but adding to the terror of it was the chaos of Jack directing from behind the monitor, and calling for whoever he was seeing on the monitor to do certain things. And the problem, though, was that nobody who was actually in the scene, me or any of the creepy people around the bar, no one ever knew if it was them that he was talking to.
Huh.
Because he wasn't calling anybody by name. He was just seeing people in the monitor, and he was saying, no, don't go that way. Turn around and hold there for a second. And so there was this real palpable sense of like, what's happening. And it really did. It kind of, in a weird way, it kind of added to this like controlled chaos of the moment. I found it to be very effective. Like, I didn't know which way to turn. I didn't know which way to look. I didn't know who I should be looking at. And I felt the confusion and the fear in a very real kind of way in those moments. And it wasn't being afraid I was going to kill. It was like, well, I don't want to screw up this scene.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that I will. And so the fear was real.
It came across. It was utterly terrifying. And I felt like I was pacing that floor with you, waiting for them to come. Then when they start looking through the holes and
yeah.
You know, you're getting a look at them up close.
Yeah.
Well,
it was fabulous. And then when they all come in at the end, I loved it.
Yeah, it was a great shot. And I had no idea when we were filming it that all of that was going to become the trailer for the show.
Right. Isn't that nuts?
It was quite a thing. I remember getting messages from people saying, "Oh, the first trailer for the show from that you did is out, and it's you."
You.
It's all the trailer is all you. It was like being led to the box, and then Harold seeing me in and the pacing around and stuff. And I was like, wow. I had no idea while we were doing it that was going to get cut into that as like the first offering of what this show was going to look like and what it was going to be about. It was really cool. It was really neat. Yeah.
I love when that happens to an actor that doesn't expect it.
Yeah, it's neat. It's like thrilling. I'm glad I didn't know. I'm glad I didn't know. Yeah, it wouldn't have worked. Wouldn't have played the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Well, Bob, thank you so much. Once again, you kill it for us. And, you know, you're always welcome. You may not want to come back, but you're always welcome.
And it will never be like this long again.
No, and I'm grateful. I'm glad you didn't get me going. I didn't dump on anyone's theories or Chris.
I'm really upset about that.
I think I named fans by name last time and like called them out and it was like so and so. I'm just imagining this all in my head.
It's exactly what it was.
No, I enjoyed that so much. I really, really did.
That's part of the fun.
I just, you know. None of us, I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
Yeah, I don't know either. Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. And I you know, I hope you did enjoy yourself.
Yes.
We're so grateful you came back.
Yeah, it was fun.
And before we end, folks, if you want to just subscribe or tell a friend or tell two. Also, at the time of this podcast, hopefully Bob will be premiering the new season of
King and Pawn.
I think early February there will be a trailer and I've seen the trailer and it's really fun and you'll get to see it. I'll post it so you'll be able to see
it. And maybe we can get your drinking buddy on here when he actually, you know, tells us he's really the mole with Donna.
that guy, I've had enough of him.
I hear it. And I'm just so happy that you guys get to, you know, work together so much because you don't really seem like you get along at all. I mean, in person. It's great. It's great when you can work with friends.
It's a great gang. We've got another season of the show Good Grief 2, which is co-produced and is starring and co-written by Katarina Bacchiolis, who played.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know, so Katarina and I have done a bunch of things together too. Like it's not a huge community. It's small enough that the people who are working on stuff seriously, we all end up crossing paths and working on different things together all the time.
We definitely have to get her back on because she is another friend of the podcast as well.
And also, I don't want to belabor the point, but also in that show, playing one member of this grief group that we're in is Sarah Campbell, who plays the monster who kills my family in that first episode.
Oh my God. Yeah,
Sarah and I have easily been in 10 projects together at least over the last 10 years. Like we're good buddies. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Is she an older person or?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. I'm thinking, I don't know why I even said that. That's a dumb thing to say.
Like makeup on
she's the one who appears in the window and says like
the older lady.
It's your grandma.
You want a piece of candy?
That's Sarah. Yeah. And
I think that's awesome.
You maybe see her in season two. She might pop up as a monster in a couple of places. And I think possibly they've got her back for season three, but I'm not sure.
We're going to definitely get you back for our preview because I know you have all the answers.
Yeah.
You do all
you're
the stuff
color man.
Because you know nothing, even though you were on the show, you don't get any script, but yet you know all the secrets of From.
Yeah, and, that's right. It's the throw off the scent. It's the throw everybody off. Yeah,
And folks, next week, hopefully we'll be able to get to season one, episode four, A Rock and Far Away. And hopefully we get to see more of Bob's legs, evidently. You know, in a bucket, in a little wheelbarrow. So
in my chest.
But again, thank you so much. We love having you on, and thank you again for such short notice. But although I know you were wrongly accused, we're gonna have your menaces. I mean, the Matthews family take us out, okay? Because I know how much you are so upset with that, but
nothing but love for them. They live in my house, so wish them all the best.
Get you home. Let's go. Come on, get in your house. Let's go. Come on.